This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 260 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'd like to introduce two co-hosts. We'll start out with Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, hi, and welcome to everybody. It's nice to be back after a week. Well, actually, I didn't have an entire week at AirVenture, but it was still a heck of a good time.
Still plenty exciting, even if it was just a half week for you, I'm sure.
That's right.
I'll introduce David Vanderhoof, our other co-host from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi, guys. Hi, Max. I did not have an exciting week, but we had a really good show last week, Max. So, and well done on the editing.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. All right. Well, as Rob mentioned, the annual EAA AirVenture Oshkosh was held last week, and that's kind of the mecca for many aviation geeks. And of course, as we said, Rob attended. We wanted to spend some time this episode talking about Oshkosh, but that thing is big. It's too big even for Rob to cover. So we've asked a couple of other friends who attended to join us for a bit of an Oshkosh debrief. So first of all, we have with us Mart Klupper from the AirPigs blog. Hi, Mart. Good to talk to you again.
Hey, great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Mart was on our show. Oh, geez. We were talking beforehand a long time ago, a real long time ago.
Well, we'll just call him Bacon Boy for short.
Yeah, we'll explain that. we'll have to explain that. I think it'll become apparent. So it's great to have Mart on the show. Mart, of course, runs the airpigs.com blog. It's pigs with a Z. Always great. You had some fantastic photos from Oshkosh that you were posting on the blog.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think I got a few good ones there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you get a new wide-angle lens?
Well, I borrowed a wide-angle, an extra wide-angle lens. And yeah, it just adds so much drama and intrigue when it's used properly. You know, you can't really get away with that all the time for sure because it's a bit extreme. But sure. Yeah, there's some pretty cool stuff there. People ought to go check it out.
Yes, definitely. And I think airplanes lend themselves to that kind of photography too.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So it worked really well.
Thank you.
Speaking of working really well, we also have joining us Martin Rotler. Hey, Martin, good to have you back.
Hello. Thank you for having me back. I'm glad to be back on the show.
Now, Martin's a faculty lecturer at the Ohio State University's Center for Aviation, and that's in Columbus, Ohio, right, Martin?
That is correct.
Martin's also a pilot and a CFI and sort of a general all-around aviation junkie. Mart's a pilot also. Mart, have you been doing much? How did you get to Oshkosh, Mart?
I drove again. Ever since I started AirPigs, I've been in a financial crisis from 2008. But I'm about to emerge from all that. So currency and flying is on my very near horizon, I believe. So
all right.
I'm pretty excited about that. I've got about 1,000 hours total time, but I haven't been current for about 18 years.
You know, I think everybody has kind of an aviation, you know, adventure that they'd like to accomplish someday. You know, for some people, it's, you know, jumping out of an airplane and doing the whole parachute thing. Yeah, definitely not for me. Not for you either, Rob, I'm sure. But here's a little secret, Mart.
Yeah.
Kind of the number one issue on my bucket list for things that I'd like to do aviation related involves you.
Really?
Yeah. Because one thing I'd love to do is have you take me up someday in a Breezy.
That, I tell you, the Breezy is truly one of the most amazing flying machines ever made. It really is.
I would love to do that.
I think it would scare the heck out of me. But even though I have never actually met Mart, I somehow have the confidence that he would keep me safe.
Well, and I'll tell you,
Max, you might change your mind, but
you haven't witnessed Mart around a grill filled with bacon.
Yeah, I was going to say, any man that cooks how many packets of bacon?
What? 14, I think it was. Yeah, a lot of bacon.
Wow. All right, so we'll talk about bacon in Oshkosh, but first we've got some aviation news we're going to talk about, a few items from the past week before we get into our Oshkosh debrief. After that, David, we have an airplane of the week.
Yeah, I got selfish this week. I decided after last week's conversation, we're going to do WB-57Fs, which is the large wing, and there's only two flying left, and NASA owns them, and our kind of using them in a clandestine environment in Afghanistan. So it's a little twist on NASA aircraft.
Okay, good. That'll be exciting. Also in this week's Australia Desk report, we have Baz Schiffers. He represented the PCDU team at Oshkosh, and he caught up with Ryan Campbell. That's the 19-year-old that's flying solo around the world. So we have an interview by Baz with Ryan Campbell. Also in Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment, he takes a further look at the Middle East and North Africa with regional expert Osama Salah. We'll look forward to that. And then we'll close out with some listener mail. We have some exciting and interesting listener mail. We'll talk about a crowdsourced LSA, if you can believe that. Also, we'll talk about a plane that was supposed to land nose first. We have something about a rude hyperbipe. Is that how you say that, David? A hyperbipe?
A hyperbipe, yep.
So you can help explain what that is. Also, we have some more, believe it or not, on in-flight thrust reverser deployment. And we have a listener story or two that we'll hopefully have time to get to. So first, though, let's start with the aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Absolutely.
Ready.
Yeah.
Our first story comes from our main man, listener Micah. This is Beechcraft lands nearly $1.4 billion deal. And this is from the Wall Street Journal. This is believed to be the largest propeller aircraft order by value in general aviation history. And of that $1.4 billion, we're talking about 105 King Air 350Is. These would be purchased by Wheels Up, which is a private aviation membership company. We'll talk about them in a second. And it also includes a maintenance contract for Wheels Up in North America and Western Europe. And the two of those together make up that $1.4 billion. So this is kind of an interesting big deal. I'm sure the folks in Wichita are very happy about this. Let's first describe what a King Air 350i is for folks who may not know. Probably, Rob, you can explain a King Air 350.
King Air 350 is sort of the top of the line turboprop built by Beechcraft, of course. It's actually one of the few turboprops still in existence, still in production here in the United States. I mean, the Piaggio Avanti is built outside of the U.S., and there just aren't a whole lot of multi-engine turboprops left. But the King Air has been around, oh my Lord, 50 years from the first one, and this is the largest of them. I mean, I think it puts eight or nine folks in the back, and it will fly, I'm almost positive it's 300 knots plus, or pretty darn close to it. But and again, the one thing that King Air has going for it is it has about a trillion, billion, gazillion flight hours of reliability behind it on those Pratt & Whitney Canada PT-6s that operate it. So anybody that wants a reliable turboprop almost always thinks King Air first, and then there are the others. So this is going to be a big deal, and how they're going to operate them is still not quite, that hasn't quite been worked out yet. Whether it's going to be just a sort of a fractional organization like NetJets operates pure jet aircraft and or what, but that part's still to come. But again, your point is Oh, the Beechcraft people are extremely happy, especially since they lost the competition for the light air support aircraft to Embraer, a couple of months ago. So this is going to help make up for it.
So this new company, this startup, Wheels Up. I found their website, which is, interestingly enough, wheelsup.com.
Doesn't say much, does it?
It doesn't say much.
There's
yeah, this is definitely something to come. There is a video. There's a link to a video on the site, which is a news report from one of the major news outlets. I can't recall which one right offhand. But I guess the guy behind this is Kenny Dichter, who was the founder of MarquisJet, and he's the founder and CEO of this Wheels Up company. And in that video interview, he said that it's a membership kind of a concept. He said that something less than $20,000 would buy you a membership. Then you would pay an annual subscription, which would be something less than, he said, $10,000, which would give you access to all these aircraft. I guess on top of that, there's an hourly rate you would pay. This is not new, but aren't most of these kind of operations dealing with jets? And
absolutely. Yeah, except for the Advantair, I believe it was, that just kind of shut its doors not long ago, that was trying a similar concept with the Piaggios. And so this is kind of trying to pick up, I guess, off, at least timing-wise. So it should be interesting to see how they do. But again, I did notice that it's nice to have this big fat order. But I guess if we were potential customers, we'd know all the information about it already, because there's not much to see on their website.
We've just explained everything that's known, at least publicly. So, yeah, so interesting. And again, it's sort of a good thing for the business aviation part of the industry, which has maybe not been recovering quite as smartly as some people would have liked. Was there any talk about this at Oshkosh?
I didn't hear a word about it, but then I did not manage to stop by the Beechcraft booth this year. So I don't know if any of the rest of you guys did, but my guess is all I would have said is, yep, 1.7 billion in orders. Pretty nice.
I hit the Beechcraft booth too early in the show to catch the news, so I didn't hear much about it either.
Okay, Martin, thanks.
And I didn't hear anything about it, but I did get some really nice pictures of the nose of several King Airs there at the booth with a little fence that was running along there. Some really, really pretty little pictures, but unfortunately that doesn't help much in understanding this deal any better.
Yeah. All right, good. Well, we'll watch this unfold. The other thing that of note in that video interview is that they expect to take 9 aircraft quickly, delivery of them quickly this year, I guess. And then the next 35 of them in the first 24 months. So it, unlike some big commercial orders that we've seen lately that don't start for, you know, years into the future, this starts pretty quickly. And again, the folks in Wichita, I'm sure, are very happy about that. All right, moving on to our next item. This is from Business Week. Why Boeing is buying up older 747s. So far in 2013, Boeing is the biggest buyer of used jets. Who would have thought? Particular with 747s, Boeing has bought 7 of the 19 older 747s that have sold so far this year. And all this data comes from Ascend. So you got to ask yourself, well, why is Boeing buying old Boeing 747s? And the answer is to sell new Boeing 747-8s. It's kind of an incentive to operators of the older aircraft. I guess manufacturers don't like to buy sort of the old problems, the old obligations from customers in order to sell them new equipment. But it does happen in the industry. And it's not only buying back your own product. Sometimes you'll see Boeing buying back or buying Airbus products and vice versa in order to sort of sweeten the deal for the operator.
Well, whatever you have to do to sell an airplane, I guess, right?
Yeah. Now, the problem, of course, next is then what do you do with these old airplanes? You know, if you can remarket them to someone else and get them off your books, that's good.
With four or five dozen of those babies already sitting out in the desert, my guess is Boeing isn't going to probably be selling them to anybody. Maybe part them out.
But they're lovely sources of spare parts.
That's right. That's what I think.
Yeah, that's always another option is to part them out. Sometimes they're worth more as parts, as spare parts, than they are as a complete aircraft. Of course, once you start that, you know, going down that path with a particular airplane, you're kind of committed. You know, you start taking it apart, and it's kind of difficult to get it back together if the conditions change later. But that may be what we'll see. And of course, that has a big impact on the spare parts market when you have surplus equipment like that out there.
Maybe they're going to hack them up and go into the upscale furniture market with some of the parts.
Yeah, we've seen that. There are a number of companies that do that now, aren't there, Mark?
There are. They're probably thinking, hey, maybe why shouldn't we be doing it?
Yeah, sure. Here's your captain's chair, you know, lounger that you can put in your TV room or whatever it is.
There are actually past examples of Boeing and, I believe, Airbus actually buying up one another's airplanes as well to help sweeten the deal for orders. I believe last year Boeing bought several Airbus A340s from, I think it was China Eastern Airlines.
Was it? Yeah.
In order to bolster their 777 orders. So they bought the A340 from them and sold them 777s instead.
Yeah, and it really kind of highlights something that we've said in the past, which is that, you know, in these big deals, these big airliner deals, it's the total commercial package that counts. And it's not always, you know, when two manufacturers are competing for the business, it's not always who has the better product. It's who has the better combined commercial deal. And in some cases, that can involve financing. That can involve cases like this, buying back older equipment. It can involve things that sometimes aren't even aviation related. Sometimes folks get pretty creative at putting together a deal for an operator that's attractive to them. All right, let's finish up with a tanker story. Now, David, before we get into this, one thing I just wanted to mention for our newer listeners who may have been confused a little bit by all the tanker references last episode, I guess we can just sort of briefly say that the Air Force tanker program was such a long and protracted sort of event that really included a series of twists and turns and backups and turnarounds and things that it was sort of a, I don't know, how long did we talk about the tanker, David? Probably a couple of years?
At least a couple of years. When I first started, it was a continuous, at least once a week, we would have something to talk about as far as KC-135s and Boeing and Airbus and Airbus fighting with Boeing fighting with Airbus. And they're all fighting with the Pentagon. And I grew to loathe talking about tankers.
That's right.
I think Dan was still in middle school when that first started.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It is in the sort of the growing up of Dan happened during the sort of the tanker saga. So anyway, that's sort of the inside joke that you may have picked up on last episode. So it was kind of amusing, David, to see that you had picked out another tanker, an actual tanker story for this episode, something from Bloomberg. This is titled Airbus Tanker Jets Fuel Boom Bug Confounds Australian Air Force. And this is not the U.S. Tanker, the Boeing tanker. This is the Airbus tanker, the KC-30A, I guess, that's based on the A330.
Right, the A330 transporter, MRTT. Now, the new tankers have both booms and drogues, and the Australians have been using their new KC-30s quite effectively as probe and drogue aircraft. However, they have had several issues with the booms, and EADS has gotten problems where we've had tests in Spain where F-16s have come up and the boom has broke off the airframe.
Yeah.
And now they're having problems getting fuel through the boom. This is a big deal for us. F-35As aren't going to come with probe and drogue. They're going to need a boom. And this is just showing EADS that Boeing has been doing this a really long time, making it easy and pumping thousands of gallons a minute through a tube at 25,000 feet is not as easy as it looks. So Australia's got a bit of a problem. They still can use their tankers, but they can't fuel things like their Wedgetails, which is their electronic countermeasures aircraft, and other sort of aircraft that require a boom until they get this system straightened out. And it also doesn't bode well for the other people who want to purchase the multi-role tanker transport with the boom. Now, Great Britain bought the Voyager, which is the 330 MRTT, but they don't have a boom requirement. Everything in the Royal Air Force is a probe and drogue method. So it's going to be interesting to see how long it takes EADS to get. Again, it's another one of those saga stories that we say that building modern aircraft isn't easy, and building tankers is even harder.
Now, I think this was first delivered, the KC-30A was first delivered in, I think, about 2011, about that time frame. So it's been out a couple of years. Well, out. It's been in, has it been in service, in actual service, or are they really still considering it kind of in development? Do you know, David?
This year, a certain Steve Vischer got to fly on the KC-30A at Avalon, and the reason why they were letting all the press aboard was they had just reached IOC, or initial operational capability. So they've been delivering them in 2011. They deliver them, they have to get hooked up with the refueling equipment, and now they're just getting to the point where they've reached operational capability, but they still can't pump gas out of their boom.
Yeah.
Details.
Yeah, just details, right, Mart? So, yeah, that doesn't make it a very effective refueling tanker.
Well, actually, it does, because out on the wings are two probe and drogue drogues that they're using for the F-18s. And so, yes, they can do air-to-air refueling. It's just right now they can't refuel one tanker to the other, and they can't refuel their aircraft that are strictly a boom requirement like the Boeing Wedgetail.
Ah, got it. All right, well, you know, we wish them well and resolving the issues. I guess, like you say, David, no one seems to be immune from development gremlins and issues these days with modern aircraft. All right, let's talk about Oshkosh now, and this is always an exciting and large event. Mart, I think you had some statistics from this year's event.
Yeah, I did, and I'm handy here at the moment now. But they were generally favorable. Attendance, I do remember reading, was essentially comparable to last year, 500,000.
Right, 500,000 visitors over the course of the week.
Which I think they kind of count the number of times that people come through. So it's not necessarily 500,000 unique visitors,
right,
but it's always been like that. So anyway, it's huge, and it seemed to me that there were a lot of people there. So
we got to see lots of people up there, and it was a good week. And even though it was a somewhat shortened week for me, but it was still a heck of a good time.
So how did it feel in comparison to previous years?
Well, since last year during Oshkosh Week or Air Venture Week, it was mid-90s almost every day. To have a show go on where actually in the morning it was a bit nippy, and there were people walking around in light jackets and sweatshirts. So it was quite a change. And of course, 2 years ago we had the floods, and the North 40 was flooded so that there wasn't even any place to put airplanes.
Hey, Rob, I hate to correct you, but that was 4 years ago was the floods.
Oh, okay. 4 years ago, Mr. Historian. Sorry, I got the date wrong.
No, I'm sorry, but the listening to Dan kick pedals in the water on a podcast one night has been burned in my brain.
I still think we ought to, you know, I still have that that video of Dan taking his first sip of Jeremiah Weed. One of these days, we're going to have to figure out a way to use that against him.
Yeah, we have the evidence.
No, but and I don't know what who else saw who, but I had a chance to talk to Mr. Fujino, who is the CEO and president of HondaJet, and I went out flying with John Zimmerman from Sporties. He took he owns an R-44 helicopter. I said, sure. So that was fun.
Yeah.
Went out in the, there's a Huey up there that was offered by the Army Aviation Heritage Foundation. Went out and talked to those guys and went flying with them. And oh my gosh, I can now understand what it was like to have been a gunner in the back of a Huey, because it was exciting.
Yeah, no doubt. Hey, let's go back to that Honda jet. I think I saw that they had two of the jets there. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. There was a red one and a blue one. You know, again, I have an interview with Mr. Fujino. Maybe we should play that in a little bit, and it'll probably give you a few of the answers. But I like them because they were in nice, bright colors. Let me just ask our two guests. Did either of you get to go see Planes, the movie?
I did.
How was it?
No, don't. How was it? Yes, no spoilers.
I liked it.
And I tried to go see it, but I got there a little, not late, meaning it had started, but late in the preparation, and there were so many people, and there was a little bit of disorganization because they were dealing with a larger crowd than they expected. So I thought, yeah, I'll just leave. I'll go see it at the theater. So I'm looking forward to that.
Another, besides the Honda jet, another new airplane that was flying, I think, was the Terrafugia Transition. That's the rotable aircraft. And did any of you guys, Martin, did you have a chance to see that?
I did stop by and see it, talked with a few of the people that were there, and saw the, I think it was the Monday, no, it was the Tuesday air show with the Terrafugia. And it was interesting. It's an interesting concept. I had maybe a little philosophical difference. The Terrafugia folks think that this will open up aviation to a whole new group of people, all at a cost of $270,000 per airplane. So I don't know. If it were me, I don't know if I'd buy it. Maybe I'd just spend $70,000 on a sports car and $200,000 on a new Cirrus, but I'm sure that there's a market for it somewhere.
Yeah, how about any other guys see the thing fly?
It looked fine. It looked like an airplane in the sense that it was in the air. But I've struggled all along with the idea, trying to mix the two concepts of cars and airplanes. And while I think it's an interesting exercise, I have a long list of reasons why I'm not terribly in support of the concept. So it was nice to see it fly. They've got progress, and that's all well and good. But I still just don't see the concept really being viable.
I think they're going to sell more of the Icons, the amphib airplane, than they're going to sell of the Terrafugia myself.
If they ever get the Icon done.
Well, that's true. But, of course, that's the nice part about Oshkosh. You'll see things, you see dreams, and some of it comes to market, some of it doesn't, but
sure,
it's just pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, it's all cool.
I saw a lot of dreams walking around the for sale airplanes on the vintage ramp, and a lot of reality when I looked in my wallet.
Oh, yeah. For folks who aren't aware, this event, it's kind of divided into areas, I guess. So you've got a seaplane area, and I guess an ultralight area, the warbirds area. Martin, did you favor any particular areas?
I really enjoyed the vintage and the warbirds area. Those are my two favorites. But I spent most of my time in the new College Park area working the booth for OSU. So that was a new addition for this year, which as a display person thought was very nice to have. But the vintage and the warbirds were my favorite.
Oh, for sure. So this was the first year that OSU has had a booth, huh?
In recent memory, yes.
And so maybe since we mentioned it, maybe you can just give us a few words about the program and for those folks who aren't aware of it.
I can remake my sales pitch. I made it a few hundred times last week.
Oh,
so what's one more time? We have about 250 majors and minors in our program. We have 19 airplanes based at The Ohio State University Airport. 3 degrees for students that want to, a degree in engineering, a degree in business, and a degree in arts and sciences, and also a minor in aviation for students that want to major in something else. And that's been one of our fastest growing parts of the program. I have students that are in the program, anything from aeronautical engineering to English.
Martin, what kind of response are you getting? Are people interested in aviation careers to a greater degree than in the past, a lesser degree? Is it pretty constant? Do you see any trend there?
If we were to base it on the trend of what we saw at Oshkosh, I mean, this was our first year there that we'd been a part, or that everyone that was there had been a part. But I think it continues to be okay. There was a lot of interest amongst engineering students. They see the need for STEM folks, the science, technology, engineering, and math. But I think particularly in light of the recently released 1500-hour rule and all of the PR surrounding that, that interest is kind of mixed at this point in time. I think it will go up, but I'm kind of seeing some questions about, got a lot of questions about how many hours do I need to be a pilot? What is the pay any better than it was 2 years ago or 4 years ago? So I think the interest is there. We need to continue to grow that interest wherever it may be. But hopefully it will still continue to be there.
Yeah.
See, I think that's really a mistake, if I could throw something in there, Martin, because I don't think we need to encourage new people at all. I think they should start taking old guys like me who already know how to fly and get them back in the cockpit. I mean, I just think we're doing this all wrong, and I hope that everybody supports that. That's over, you know.
So you're suggesting, Rob, that somebody should put you in the cockpit of a commercial airplane?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes, of course.
I'm going to stick with Mart in the Breezy.
Oh,
well, the interesting thing that was kind of big news, I didn't hear anything about how well it went. I saw some of the things going on, but during the second half of the week at the air show, which was something that had never been done before, SkyWest was actually doing interviews and simulator sessions in Redbird simulators and offering conditional job offers at the show. For
wow.
People.
That seems significant. Yeah.
That was significant. And there were a few other regionals. There was one other regional. American Eagle was there. And they are still hyping up their $5,000 sign-on bonus for regional pilots. Wow. So, Rob, if you want to go fly a CRJ, they might have a spot for you.
Now, Mart, one of the aspects of Oshkosh that's I think that a lot of people walk away with as being impressive is the sort of the social component of it. The people that you meet, the old friends, the new friends. And you're kind of part of that in some ways, aren't you?
Well, yeah. AirPigs is a great way to connect, but mostly using Twitter, a little bit of Facebook. But those social tools have really brought together a large number of AB geeks. And then I have a thing there in the campground at the Camp Scholler called Camp Bacon, which is just we pre-register a fairly large area, and we sort of have, it's kind of invitation style as far as the folks that are staying there. And then I have a couple bacon parties, but it really helps to, focus on that community aspect of spending Oshkosh time with a lot of other folks, you know, especially in the evening. Of course, everybody goes their own way during the day, but to have that time in the evening around a fire and, food and fire and talk, and on a couple of days, even bacon, it's...
So you got to tell me, Mark, when we talk about a bacon party, just exactly mm-hmm. what does that mean? I know there's bacon involved, but I mean, is it, do you just cook it and eat it? Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, you know, it's really, it's, well, it's all about
bacon.
It's all about chewing the fat.
I got it.
Oh, God.
Oh.
That was good.
And how many years have you been saving that up, Matt?
Well, that's the way I've been promoting it here lately, because honestly, it's even more about talking, you know, hangar flying and just having a fun time talking aviation. But there's a pretty good chance that you'll be able to have a piece of bacon in your hand. So it's just kind of a clever way, and it especially works well since I'm, you know, my website's Air Pigs.
So yes, sure.
Seems to fit perfectly, and everybody loves bacon. I mean, don't they?
Sure. Rob, did you go to the bacon party?
I mean, yeah. There were so many cool things. In fact, we've got there might even be a story up on Jetwine that came out a few hours ago that has something to do with the Air Pigs guys and the bacon party.
Really?
And,
wow.
Alan and other people's airplanes and Dan Pimentel from Airplanista and the award. Oh, just... Seriously, if I can just interject one thing, Mart is so right on the money, because the show is the show, but it's all the people you hang out with at night and shoot the breeze with and eat bacon with or drink beer with or pop or whatever your choice is. And there are just so many neat people that would have never met each other in any other way at that show other than the social media aspect, whether it's Twitter, blogging, or anything else. And it's just, it's the community just keeps growing year after year after year.
So let me ask this. This is a question sort of on behalf of the people who have not been and who might be contemplating going in the future. Is it clicky?
Oh, no. I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so. I'd say that, you know, there's that common bond of the love for flying, and that can be just as easily done between a student pilot who hasn't even soloed yet talking to a guy who owns a $1 million P-51 and just getting along great, you know, having a great time, spending time together. And it's all across every spectrum. I mean, I've never run into, you know, and I'm sure there is some of it somewhere to be found, but especially out there in the campground, which one thing I'd like to say real quick, it's mind-boggling the scope, the size of what this campground is. I really don't know the modern numbers of how many people are there, but it used to be 40,000 people, and if anything, it seems it would be more. And to think of having that many people that are in tents and travel trailers and then motorhomes and buses, you got a little bit of everything there, and the same thing in a tent right next to sometimes a huge, you know, $1 million bus, and everybody gets along fantastic. I mean, it is just, I don't know of anywhere else on earth that you can have this many people this close together for a week long and behave so well and be so nice to each other. It's just, it's totally remarkable. It's absolutely,
I don't
fantastic.
Think I've ever even heard of a fight.
Yeah, same here. Adventure. And I've been, this was somewhere around my 36th or 37th year at Oshkosh. I've missed a few over the years, but I've always camped. Yeah, you don't even hear people yelling at people. It's the strangest but most wonderful thing, the way this all just comes together.
So, Max, can I just mention an anniversary?
Okay.
I mean, I bet I have everybody beat on this one.
Yeah, you do.
This was my... It's actually, what is today? This is 2013, and my first EAA event was 50 years ago this summer, and I was just a kid out at Rockford at the air show, and I was one of those kids with the orange paddles helping to park airplanes, and I just thought that was the coolest thing in the whole world, and I got to tell you, if you're a geek and or even thinking about being an airplane geek, you got to go to Oshkosh. There's so many neat people, neat airplanes, neat experiences. And here I am, you know, now almost, well, let's see, let me do the math. That means I'm almost 40. So, you know, but it's, and I've never been sorry for any of it. I mean, it's always interesting.
David, you were going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to chime in. It is kind of amazing that you do things at Oshkosh that you wouldn't do normally, like leave your cell phone charging in the charging center across the way, or leave all of your electronics outside of the bathroom. And when you come back outside, it's still there.
Mm-hmm. And oh, that is so true.
And
yes.
I mean, it's
people don't even lock their car.
The other part about it is, it's the only place I know, the only campsite I know in the world that is cleaner when people leave than it was when they arrived.
Wow.
You can't imagine all of those people, and the place is immaculate. You know, people get that you don't drop things on the ground because airplanes eat things up. And there's nothing better than the feeling at Oshkosh of walking up to somebody and just talking to a complete stranger about their airplane or what they saw, or, you know, and the next thing you know, you've made lifelong friends. I have to say this year was kind of painful sitting back outside of Philadelphia watching the world go by Twitter and Facebook and stuff, and the emails that I would get from people saying, you're not here, why?
Yeah.
Rod Roddick said, you know, the first year you go for the airplanes, the second year you go for the airplanes and the people, and then after that, pretty much you go for the people.
The last time I was there was 2002, and being a change from a high school student to today, and now having been in the industry for not as long as Rob, but for a little while, it was also fantastic to see just how many people from aviation that I knew from all different facets of the industry. I had family friends that I saw from back when I was a kid, all the way through students that I had class with to anything else. And it's a fantastic gathering of people. And even though you might not know someone, the best way, if you're ever worried about getting someone onto a conversation, is to ask them whether they flew in or they drove in. And if they flew in, they probably have a story for you.
Yeah.
And if they drove in, they probably have a story for you, too.
Martin, was there something from the air shows that sort of stood out in your mind, or something that you just really enjoyed more than anything else?
Absolutely. Matt Youngkin, Night Air Show, and his Beech 18.
And so, Martin, kind of can you describe that a little bit? I mean, what was it like to watch that?
It was a Beech 18 that was lit up. They didn't rig any fireworks to it. Some of the other airplanes had actual fireworks rigged to them, but it had the lights and a Phantom of the Opera soundtrack. And he did several loops and rolls and things like that for the crowd that was very exhilarating.
Wow. Rob, how about you? Did you see part of the air show, something that you really liked?
Well, I did... see the air show a couple of different times. And of course I have to admit I had seen the Beech 18 at before, because he's been down at Addison Airport in the Dallas area for their Kaboom Town at 4th of July. But this year we had Jetman.
That's right.
I think I couldn't quite be sure, because everybody was saying something that sounded like the original Superman. Look up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. But we're not really sure, because we really couldn't see him very well.
I think it's what it was.
I think yeah, that
he didn't
was
actually
the,
come very close to the ground, but that was no, because that, he needed to be able to shoot, I guess. Yeah, I don't think that worked out very well.
Okay, just difficult to see. I think that was his first American or North American appearance, something like that.
Display.
Yeah, display. Yeah.
The FAA wouldn't let him fly any lower than 2,500 feet. So you can imagine a guy with a really small little wing on his back at 2,500 feet, unfortunately, is not very big.
Hmm.
You know, it was still very cool. I mean, I think it was neat, but I think on one hand that we were underwhelmed to a certain extent, because I had visions of, you know, at least a 500-foot pass or something right down the runway.
Yeah.
And of course, we didn't get that. I did see him loop it once. And so, yeah, I mean, it was nice, it was good, and amazing on one hand, but yeah, definitely a little less than impressive visually because of the distance.
Yeah, that's too bad. Now, I understand he has a protege that he's, or a student, someone that he is teaching to do this kind of thing. So I guess that there are at least two people in the world now who are kind of crazy enough to...
So Jet Man and Jet Baby?
Yeah, Jet Boy, or I don't know what they're called.
Jet Boy.
Yeah. Maybe it's Dan.
They did post a really cool video of Jet Man flying with the B-17. So that made almost all of it worthwhile.
Wow.
Yeah, it was cool. It just didn't quite translate, I don't think, the way they expected it to. The way the in-flight sort of shots, you know, like with the B-17, yeah. that made a big difference. But hey, that's okay. It was still pretty neat.
Cool. One thing that was kind of neat is that they did have the big LED displays out on the flight line, two big ones this year, and Live Air Show TV was doing coverage of the majority of the air show, if not the whole air show. And so when Jetman was flying, they did have live feed view from cameras on him.
Uh-huh.
So if you were somewhere where you could see the big LED screens, it was greatly enhanced compared to those not being there. So, and all things considered, too, this is kind of an interesting thing to mention, because this was the first year they'd ever had LED displays out there on the flight line to help with, you know, having a bigger experience. And I know some people were unsure as to whether or not it'd be a good idea, but I think it worked really, really well.
All right. Any other kind of interesting observations or takeaways from this year's event?
Well, I had one that I wanted to share that I wondered if anyone else had noticed up there. But the Husky, which is, you know, a lot like a Super Cub, the Husky that's been set up to run on compressed natural gas.
Ah, yes.
That seemed like a really interesting project, and I didn't get a lot of information about it. But the Everlane actually runs on dual fuel. It can run on avgas, and with the flip of a switch, it changes over and makes a few alterations and can instantly start running on the CNG. And there seems to be a tremendous amount of potential with this because the CNG is like 85 cents a gallon.
Oh, wow.
And it's 138 octane, and the engines apparently run well on it. And now the challenge is it has a fairly large tank mounted at the bottom of the fuselage.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Marty, is that's the one that has kind of that big sort of belly bulge underneath?
Exactly, nice. Yeah, and it's not attractive. And, it you know, to me, you look at it and you think, well, I wonder how that does in an extremely hard landing. You know, so, I mean, there's
oh, wow, yeah.
There's some concerns there, but it's not the final concept by any means. This is just purely a test bed, and honestly, at the moment, it's seeming remarkably viable as we would go through generation 2 and 3, and then, you know, down the road here, maybe actually have an incredibly affordable fuel that the engines run well on and burn clean. So this could be, you know, obviously infrastructure is a huge issue there. We don't have that really in place. But one of their concepts is that for a training aircraft that's, you know, never going to have to, or I shouldn't say never, but rarely going to have to refuel to do its training work, this would be a tremendous way to vastly reduce the expense of operation. I hope we all start talking about it more and encouraging that effort that Aviat is working on with that.
I did see a interesting announcement from one of the aircraft leasing companies for flight training that they had put in an order for the Red Hawk, the turbo diesel powered 172 for flight training use that would run on Jet A and pump about gallons per hour, so which is about half of what the 172 under normal avgas would operate. So I think that would catch the eye of some of the flight training providers out there.
Yeah, for sure. Interesting. Yeah, it's good to see that kind of focus. All right, Rob, any final thoughts from you?
Oh, I sat in on the press conference that Jack Pelton gave on day two, I think it was. Jack Pelton, of course, is the chairman right now of EAA, and they talked about how their new program called Martin or Mart, you might have to help me, and I think it's called It's Not Over Yet or something like, or It Ain't Over, but in the sense that EAA is not going to sit back and politely allow the FAA to continue to tax them for air traffic control services, and so I think we may see an interesting change to some of the political dynamics from all the alphabet groups, because the AOPA was there and NBAA and the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, and they were all kind of beating ignore that noise in the back.
Is that
they were
Simba?
All kind of beating the tom-tom of you know, maybe it's time and we've had enough.
Well, one other thing I wanted to add was that with this, you know, the change in leadership that we've had in the EAA really seemed to bring a fresh and extremely positive perspective to the entire event. There was some, I feel like there was some tension for sure in the past. And now things have changed, and it seems to be for it's a really positive change. I just felt like the vibe was really good at Oshkosh this year. And in fact, it helps to bolster my effort, which I've been kind of doing this on the side at AirPigs for a while. I'm very old school. And to me, there's only one word that describes the event, and that's Oshkosh. That other word, I don't even say it. That's how against it I am. But I have, there's old school reasons why I'm against it. But anyway, my hope would be that this would be a really good time for us for the EAA, actually, to focus on it being Oshkosh and kind of picking up on that old vibe that we had years ago that just made the event so incredible.
Mm. All right.
My final thought is that the EAA folks that I worked with and that we worked with were fantastic, and they made a great show for most, or for all of the exhibitors that were out there. So they were great to deal with. They were really friendly. They made it a great experience for everyone, and I think everyone really appreciates that.
All right, good. Great comments. Thanks all for the Oshkosh debrief. Really appreciate it. Certainly motivates one to start to think about next year already and attending. Mart, why don't you tell folks where they can find AirPigs online and the website and Twitter and all those things?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's AirPigs with a Z on the end, so it's AIRPIGZ.com. And then at Twitter, it's at AirPigs. And Facebook, it's Facebook.com/AirPigs.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Mart. And Martin Rotler.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Martin, where can folks find more about the program or follow you online?
You can find out more about the OSU Center for Aviation Studies at aviation.osu.edu. If you want to come find my Twitter page and irreverent observations there about life and everything else, you can follow me at Martin Rotler, MartinRotler, one word.
Great. And both of you, thanks so much for helping us out.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Rob recorded a number of interviews at Oshkosh, including this one with Mishimasa Fujino, president and CEO of the Honda Aircraft Company.
The Honda Jet has been under development for 27 years. It was the brainchild in 1986 of a young Honda engineer, Mishimasa Fujino. Fujino is now the president and CEO of Honda Aircraft Company based in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Very glad to talk.
And welcome to Oshkosh.
Ah, thank you. It is my pleasure to participate in Oshkosh every year.
And how many of these have you been to?
I don't remember. I come almost every year from 86.
The Honda team brought a pair of special new Honda jets to the Air Venture show this year. One composite fuselage of the new Honda jet was painted red and white. The other, a brilliant blue and white. And what made these two jets so special?
This is an executive conforming, FAA-conforming aircraft.
Conforming means these aircraft are pretty close to what someone who purchases one of the light jets will receive on delivery. The aircraft is powered by a GE Honda engine that was developed especially for this airplane. Not only do the engine nacelles that rise above the top of the wing on the Honda jet make it stand out in a crowd, but so does its performance. The Honda jet will fly just under 1,200 nautical miles with four people on board at altitudes as high as 43,000 feet. Its top speed, 420 knots. The Honda jet can land and get stopped in under 3,000 feet of runway.
And is this airplane going to be single pilot certified?
Yes, that is very important for light jet design requirements.
And after years of careful development, FAA certification is coming. Soon.
This aircraft is already in flight test program. This airplane is made a first flight 2011.
And when do you expect the flight testing to be completed?
Based upon current schedule, we expect to take a FAA certification by the end of next year and start delivery.
But how much of the flight test program has already been flown?
We don't disclose the exact number for our flight test hours.
But Fujino's goal wasn't simply to capture the market, rather to expand it.
We try to incorporate new technology.
But 27 years is a long time in development. Why so long?
Because if we just introduce new aircraft just slightly better than existing aircraft, there is less meaning for Honda to enter into the aviation business. Mm-hmm. So our goal is to introduce new high technology, over-the-wing engine mount, composite fuselage, new engine or new design from scratch. So that's why we need a lot of tests to make sure no reliability issue, no quality issue. And of course, we got to be sure that the best performance. We do not want to compromise. You know, we may deliver airplane to the customer 1 or 2 years earlier, but our choice is we want to introduce best product. That is our approach. As for maximum speed, we are exceeding 420 knots, so this is the best in class. And the range is about 1,200 nautical mile. This is a kind of typical or slightly better than other small jet. In short, you know, Honda Jet provide the best speed and the best fuel efficiency.
Listening to Fujino talk, I wondered about the other light jets on the market.
Who do you think is the competitor aircraft for the Honda Jet?
I do not specifically say the competitors, but probably, you know, light jet in the market. Few light jet from Brazil or light jet from Wichita. Those are major competitors.
And just in case there are any teething problems with the new Honda Jet, the company's established a network of 10 service centers across North America and Europe. I had to admit, I really like that red and white Honda Jet I saw sitting on the ramp at AirVenture this year.
We are already taking order, but we have a lot of orders, so if you place order now, you may have to wait a little bit.
How long is a little bit?
Maybe delivery come 2 to 3 years.
Finally, I wondered about Mr. Fujino, a man who's already attended dozens and dozens of AirVenture events.
Are you a pilot yourself?
Not yet. So, yeah, I try. You know, when I came to the United States, that was my first target.
For the Airplane Geeks and Jetwine, I'm Rob Mark.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with the Airplane of the Week.
Thanks, Max. The airplane of the week, the WB-57F Canberra. We've talked in the past about the Canberra. Recently, an English Electric Canberra PR-9 was returned to flight status in Great Britain, and it made its debut at the Royal International Air Tattoo 2013. The PR-9 was retired by the RAF in June 2006, leaving two Canberras flying in the United States. 2013 marks the 50th anniversary of NASA operating B-57s. It marks the 60th anniversary of the first flight of the Martin B-57A. The B-57 was a license-built English Electrus Canberra B-2. Eventually, Martin would change the airframe to a tandem cockpit and make engine upgrades. Like the Canberra, the B-57 was exported to other nations' air forces. One interesting note is the Indian Air Force Canberras were used to bomb Pakistani B-57B intruders. A version of aircraft fratricide? Australia would fly their Canberra B-20s next to B-57Gs in exemplary service in the skies over Vietnam. Eventually, the B-57 would be used for more specialized versions. Before the U-2, there was Bald Eagle, the program that created the RB-57D. The RB-57D was a high-altitude reconnaissance aircraft. In drone parlance, we would say it was HAL, high-altitude long endurance. The RB-57D's wing grew the 64-foot wing to become 108 feet overall. The cord was also increased, making it a huge wing area of 1,500 square feet versus the standard 960 feet of the standard Canberra. To supplement the wing, the J-65s of the B would be replaced with 10,500 thrust-pound Pratt & Whitney J-57-9s. The Bombay was removed and replaced with electronics and or cameras. Surprisingly, these changes did not increase the overall weight of the aircraft. Eventually, 20 RB-57Ds were built in four batches. Group A, which six were built, were single-seat aircraft with cameras. Group B, which seven were built, were similar to the Group A, but could also be air-to-air refueled. Group C, six were built. These were designed for electronics intelligence and signals intelligence. The air refueling was retained. The second cockpit was returned for the specialist to operate the electronics. Group D was one was built, had a sophisticated mapping cameras and radar. The 20 aircraft were eventually retired due to a systemic issue with the wing spar of the enlarged wing. It also became clear that the U-2 system was a much better platform. By 1959, the U.S. Air Force had begun to retire them to the boneyard. But like many aircraft that go to David Monathan, the RB-57s would rise again as better aircraft. The last RB-57D was struck in from service in 1970. The need to replace the RB-57D caused the Air Force to look for to find a replacement. In 1962, a group of General Dynamics looked into improving the 57D. As part of the U.S. Air Force's Big Safari project, a new aircraft was rolled out on May 16, 1962, the RB-57F. The 57D was big. The 57F was ginormous. The 106-foot wingspan was again increased to 122 feet. The surface area became 2,000 square feet over the 1,500 of the 57D. Now, keep in mind that the wing area of a 747-8 is 2,750 square feet. Using technology from Convair's B-58, the wings were made of honeycomb sandwich panels. The size of the wing caused the removal of flaps. The tail grew to 19 feet and was created wider. The stabilizer area was also doubled. This was all done to provide additional control when operating at 80,000 feet. Like the 57D, the wings were wet and to provide additional space for fuel. The fuel now was for the Pratt & Whitney TF-33 turbofan engines. The TF-33 provided double thrust of the J-57s. The RB-57 could also be refitted with removable Pratt & Whitney J-60s. These potted jet engines were not like the potted engines on a KC-97 or a B-36, which used the jets for additional thrust at takeoff. The J-60s were not equipped with air starters. Once the aircraft was at 30,000 feet, the windmill effect of forward airspeed through the compressor will start the engines. The effect of the two J-60s was at 40,000 feet, they generated an additional 33,000 pounds of additional thrust, giving the RB-57F an additional 2,000 to 3,000 feet in altitude. With the J-60s removed, the aircraft could have slipper pods or use the four pylons for test equipment. The nose was also lengthened to accommodate additional cameras and navigation equipment. In 1963, the 7407th Support Squadron operated the first two converted Fs. The two aircraft operated from West Germany to East Germany in the Baltic Sea. The average operating altitude was 65,000 feet. The two aircraft were so successful that the U.S. Air Force agreed to purchase 19 more in 64, and production ended in 1967. Officially, please note my air quotes, the RB-57's mission was weather reconnaissance, the majority of which was air sampling. Air sampling is the ability to detect radiation that has come from a nuclear test or blast. The majority of this at the time was studying the tests carried out by China. Another role was strategic reconnaissance in Europe. One RB-57F, on December 14, 1965, was possibly shot down by an S-75 Divina SAM. The crew were believed to have ejected out of the aircraft before it went into the Black Sea. However, their ultimate fate has never been found out. The air sampling mission caused them to be deployed to Pakistan in 1965. Pakistan borrowed, again using air quotes, one RB-57F to monitor Indian movements and was actually equipped with a 4,000-pound bomb load. The operational altitude was, again, 65,000 feet. The aircraft was forced down in Peshawar province. It suffered 170 bullet holes and had debris from two SAMs which exploded around it on final approach. By 1972, the wings were showing cracks like that happened in the RB-57Ds. A decision again was made that was too costly to repair them. Eight were placed in storage in 1973, and the remainder was sent there in 1974. Overall, three were lost in service, two with wing spar accidents. The other aircraft was the one that crashed in the Baltic Sea. NASA was given three WB-57Fs and given the numbers 926, 925, and 928. Transfers occurred in the early 1970s. NASA had operated the aircraft out of Ellington Field in support of the Johnson Space Center. The electronics bay can hold up to 6,000 pounds of sensors and current data equipment. NASA has gotten its money's worth out of the WB-57s. Currently, only 926 and 928 are flying. 925 was used for spare parts. The WB-57s have an endurance of 6.5 hours with a 2,500-mile range. A little over 12-mile high, the crew has to wear pressure suits. Each suit weighing 31 pounds, it's similar to the pressure suits the shuttle crews wear. During its 50-plus career, it has been used for ARES, or the Airborne Remote Earth Sensing. For Discovery's first return to space mission, the RB-57Fs were modified with a gimbaled high-definition video camera on the nose. This was called WAVE, the WB-57F Ascent Video Equipment. This allowed NASA to track from high altitude the shuttle. Recently, both 926 and 928 have been stripped of their meatballs, given low visibility markings. In 2006, NASA 928 was sent to Kandahar Airport to fly missions over Afghanistan. The official reason, again air quotes, was avarice, or the airborne visible infrared imaging spectrometer, to observe and find natural resources in the mountains. And if it happened to find some Taliban in the caves, what a coincidence. Since that point, the WB-57s have been rotating in and out of Kandahar. They are now carrying the Bakken, Battlefield Airborne Communications Node. Backing connects to similar electronic platforms. To quote science fiction, it's the Babelfish or universal translator for military platforms. Through the WB-57F, an F-18 can talk to ground control or forward control or vector in a B-1 bomber. With its loiter time and its capacity to fly at altitudes well above man-portable surface-air missiles, it's the perfect aircraft. Not bad for one who's been flying for 50-plus years, huh, Robert? The first A in NASA stands for aeronautics. The WB-57s have been quietly supporting that mission for over 50 years. We as taxpayers have gotten our money out of 926 and 928. Currently, there's no retirement date for these two aircraft. So if you go to NASA.gov, you can fly your experiment on a WB-57F. Where's my box of airplane geek buttons? This is David M. Vanderhoof, your historian, signing off.
Wow, thanks, David. You know, that's an airplane that I knew absolutely nothing about.
Yeah, and I mentioned Pratt & Whitney three times.
I know you did. I know. I was waiting to see if you mentioned the TF-33s, because I knew that was the last engine on there. But, you know, when you look at the photographs of these things, the first thing that strikes you is just the width of the, not the length, but the width of the wings. I mean, these things are, what do you call that, cord? These things are really broad. I mean, it's really kind of striking.
They are a very large aircraft, and I used to get Air Force magazine when I was a little kid, and every year they would have their Air Force almanac, and there would always be a picture in there of the WB-57Fs, and I always just thought that was the coolest looking thing.
They are. All right. Thanks again, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Well, g'day folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 260. And Steve Vischer here, flying solo this week. Grant is not feeling 100%, so we're going to be very kind. We've been giving him the week off. But seeing as we're talking this week about Oshkosh, we thought we'd present a quick interview this week from our PCD reporter, Baz Sheffers, who was representing our team over there this week. And as much as we would like to think we'll never speak to Baz again because he didn't take us with him, but I guess we couldn't all go. But it was great that Baz was there, and he caught up with young Ryan Campbell. Now, for those of you who've been following along Ryan's journey, he's a young 19-year-old man. We've talked about him before in recent weeks on the Australia Desk, and he's flying solo around the world in a Cirrus SR-22 in his attempt to become the youngest person to do so. So we've caught up with him quite a few times on his trip. He's transited the Pacific. He's done many great things in the US. And, of course, he spent the week there at AirVenture. So Bear's caught up with him and recorded this great interview.
Ryan, you made it to Oshkosh, and you look like you've been busy here. You look a bit tired. How's it going on the trip?
Yeah, it's been really good. To come into Oshkosh was really exciting, but I've been lucky enough to come here before, but this week's been very different. There's been a lot of interest in the flight, a lot of interest with the aeroplane, the way it looks, and I haven't really had a lot of time to look around and be the typical tourist, but hopefully over the next few days I'll get to do that before I head off.
And which approach did you do? Did you go in IFR or did you follow the FISC approach VFR?
No, I come in on the FISC approach. I thought that was, a bit more exciting. It was the kind of the ritual of Oshkosh. So I come in and it was busy. It was, I was very nervous, probably more nervous than any other flight that I've had on the world trip so far. But I was told to rock my wings. I got told good rock. I was cleared to land on the green dot, and I got a welcome to Oshkosh. So I got everything that I could have asked for, and it was really exciting. It all went really well. I got straight off the runway and then taxied down here into Aeroshell's, Phillips Plaza this year, into the main square of the show. So it was very exciting. It was especially to see all the family in 60 minutes here. You know, when I arrived, it just made it even better.
And how did they identify you? Were you the Cirrus with all the funny stickers?
No, I was just a white Cirrus, and I was sitting very upright and eyes were very wide open. I was, I was trying to be on the ball as much as possible. There was a lot of aeroplanes out there. I had a flight of three or four T6s and, pop up behind me to follow me in. So it was a typical Oshkosh arrival. It was everything I imagined.
And it took you quite a while to get here because obviously after your long Hawaii to Van Nuys leg, you've been on a bit of a tour of the US. So where have you been?
I have, yeah. It was, when I landed in Van Nuys, that was kind of the conclusion of, the long Pacific crossing. It was a box to tick. I could sit down. I took the HF aerial off the aeroplane. I covered up the fuel tank in the back, and It was good. I could kind of, you know, relax, sit down and relax and plan across the USA. And I set off, and in short, I'm blown away by the hospitality and the care that they take of you here in the United States, the airspace system, everything to do with general aviation is phenomenal. I've never filled the aircraft up myself. I've never been able to open the door before there's been chocks under the aeroplane. And, you know, even to the point where they wouldn't let me step down onto the tarmac, they had to put a mat out. You know, they really have taken really good care of me. And it's not just because of the flight. I think this is a general, way that they... you know, they approach you here. There's a lot of respect and just typical hospitality. So I've been to Van Nuys, out of Van Nuys and across to Tucson in Arizona, tour of the Boneyard, and I got to meet the commander of the base there, which was quite a cool thing to, you know, be allowed to do. That's a phenomenal place, and almost sad to see the airplane sitting there doing nothing. And then I went from Tucson on to Fredericksburg in Texas. I met some fantastic people who stayed on the airfield and lived in a hangar there. And Bob was his name. He took me flying in a Beechcraft Stagger Wing. He was also an instructor. So I do have staggering time signed off in the logbook now, which is pretty exciting. And then after that, I was out to what was meant to be Smyrna in Tennessee. A weather delay meant that I spent the night in Greenville in Mississippi, which was my fuel stop. Very early start the next morning, a short flight, really enjoyable. Just, you know, as the sun came up, I went into Smyrna, Tennessee, and the Cirrus was pulled to pieces. They were very, very happy with it during the 100 hourly. They were very happy with, you know, just how good it was. There's normally a lot of glitches in an aircraft they haven't worked on before, but they were blown away to only find three or four really little things. So that's a bit of a confidence booster for me, and definitely shows what a good aeroplane it really is. After that, I left Smyrna and headed across to Dare County, landed in Dare County in North Carolina, grabbed some fuel, and then I zipped out over the Outer Banks of North Carolina and landed in Kitty Hawk. And I literally got to fly in the same little block of airspace that the Wright brothers first took off on December 17th, 1903. So that was really historical and a good way to finish off that, you know, US mainland crossing, because I had, you know, spotted the ocean on the other side, which meant I wasn't too lost. And that's it. I jumped up there in North Carolina, and I've flown here via West Virginia for a quick fuel stop there in Parkersburg, and I landed in Appleton, a couple of days there to kind of get the aircraft ready to fly into Oshkosh and to, you know, recite the NOTAM in my sleep, and then I flew into here. It would have been on Monday morning, and as you said, a pretty full-on week now, and just getting your head ready to jump back in the plane and take off again. I am ready to go. I'm ready to move on.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Good you say that about the whole airspace system and the fixed base operators, the FBOs, that put your chucks on and put the mat out for you and fill up your airplane. It's when I talk to people here in the US and say, well, if you fly into a GA airfield in Australia, you just tie it down and you try and find a gate, and then you call the number of that's listed there to see someone who can open it for you and can let you back in. And if you need any repairs on your airplane, you know, good luck. You're just going to have to walk the hangars and see if anyone's interested in helping you. And I think that's one of the things that makes aviation so great and prosperous here, whereas, you know, in Australia, let's face it, it's on the decline. The sports side of it, recreational, is still growing, but flying this kind of aircraft and flying it for business, flying it for, you know, for pleasure, for going on longer trips, this doesn't really exist anymore. And it's awesome to experience that. And if you ever have the experience to come flying in the US, I would definitely recommend it, and I'd say you would as well.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, yes, in Australia we don't have the numbers to kind of allow us to have FBOs at every airport and such things, but I think there's a lot that we can do to make it better. You know, it's phenomenal here. I was checked out of the motel by the owner of one of the FBOs and taken to his home in Tennessee. I stayed with his family for 3 days, and they're now all really, really good friends and people I'll get to know and come back and visit. But yeah, everything you do here is phenomenal. You know, the way they treat you in the air as an IFR pilot, it just seems to work, you know, really, really well, and I've really enjoyed it. There's something that I've found that is phenomenal is that phone number 1-800-WX-BRIEF. And someone said to call that. I called that number the first time in Hawaii, and I was a very nervous little man with that leg in front of me, but I submitted my flight plan over the phone. And there was a lot of waypoints to call out in, using the phonetic alphabet, so it took about 15 minutes. But at the end of that, the guy was really, really nice. He said to me, would you like a weather brief? And I said, yes, please. And he went on for 20 minutes.
Yeah, and it's great, not just IFR, but I've got some friends here that fly VFR here, and things like flight following is just such a common thing here, and it really helps them along. It'd be great if we have the resources in Australia to have that as well. But you know, you can always come back here and fly some more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I hear fly following all the time, and although I am flying IFR, a couple of times I've shot a short VFR leg, whether it's been for fuel into Dare County and then on to where it's not worth filing IFR. And I've never had a bad experience in crossing the States. And that's exactly right. I'll definitely end up back here in the next couple of years when the flight and the following kind of plans with youth in aviation, schools tour and stuff is finalised, I'll be back over here. There's just so many opportunities, I think, if you really want to excel and get some good time and good experiences under your belt, this is the place to be.
Awesome. So I understand this is pretty much the last of your media appointments in Oshkosh this week, and you'll be off shopping and looking at all the other aircraft from now on.
It is. I'm not the typical tourist with a camera on this week. It's been great though. It's a different experience that I'll never have again. But I am finished up. Yeah, a lot of the team, the crew that come over to see me has moved on, and now I've got just a couple of days to get the aircraft ready to go, but to like you said, have a look around and do some shopping.
And where on from here?
I'm setting just off to Appleton on Sunday, just a short 30-40 minute flight to get out of the mess here at Oshkosh and get the ferry tank all set up, put some fuel in there, and set off to Bangor in Maine.
And after Bangor, is that where you start your big leg across the Atlantic?
That's where I'll start my international travel. I just got a zip from Bangor back up to Goose Bay in Canada, which is still quite a long flight, but it'll put me in Canada at Goose Bay, which is the gateway to the Pacific for a lot of ferry flights. For a lot of ferry flights. So I'll then go from Goose Bay to Reykjavik, and then Reykjavik down to Wick, Scotland, which obviously puts me into the UK and Europe.
Awesome. Well, we'll keep tracking you, and I'm sure Steve will be in touch with you by phone on one of your destinations to see how you're going, and wish you all the best.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, and I look forward to talking to you.
Fantastic stuff. And I tell you what, I don't know about you folks, but Ryan sounded a little subdued there. I'd say he's been up to so much on this trip there that he's going to sleep very, very well when he gets back here to Australia. And I also note on his website that at day 72, which just passed during the last week, that marks the halfway point of his trip around the world. So doing really well. And one of the other things I noticed this week, which was very good, I thought, was that he caught up with young Jack Wiegand, who only recently set the same record that Ryan is now hitting around the world in an attempt to break. And I thought that was a very good thing that those two young men could catch up with each other and swap a few stories and grab a few photographs together. It was really, really good stuff. Now, if you'd like to follow Ryan's progress, you can always do that at his website, which is teenworldflight.com.au. They've got live tracking on there, and you can follow Ryan's Twitter feed at Teen World Flight. And you'll find him at Teen World Flight on just about every other social media space that you can imagine. So good luck to Ryan, and thanks very much to Baz for taking some time out from his busy schedule of activities there at AirVenture, the lucky devil, and we really appreciate him getting that interview. So that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. We'll be back next week. I'm sure Grant will be feeling much better by then, so we'll see you then. Until then, I'm Steve Fisher. Cheers, folks.
I really enjoyed that interview from Bass. I think he does a heck of a good job for a guy from Australia, but then actually he's really not from Australia like Stephen Grant and all that. But, long as we're just kind of commenting, or at least I'm commenting, Bass stayed at Camp Jetwine this year before he went up to AirVenture with me.
Oh, that's right.
It was really a lot of fun. And he and I went out and had pizza at the Australians' favorite pizza joint, Giordano's here in Evanston. And one thing that amazed me, though, is that Simba the Wonder Dog was very well behaved with Bass, unlike the insane rowdiness he seems to display when he's around Steve Fisher. I don't quite know what that means, but
it must mean something.
It's something to say.
All right, well, let's see how well Peter Johnson makes out this week across the pond.
Today, we welcome back our expert on the Middle East and North Africa, Osama Sala. Osama, welcome back across the pond.
Thank you. Good to be back.
It's great to have you. Osama, when we last talked, Etihad were in the news, and I don't think they've really ever been out of it. They really are expanding, aren't they?
Well, Etihad has to play catch-up with the big cousins in the area, Emirates and Qatar Airways, and they have done it in a very unusual, novel way.
Yeah.
is by equity stakes.
Just looking in the regional press, there's new routes being added to the network almost every week.
Yes, and they've just had, a week ago, they had a letter of intent with the Serbian government for an equity stake in Jet Airways.
Wow.
2 days ago, they signed a co-chair with Korean Air, which is a 546 co-chair deal, and that will cover 350 destinations.
Yeah.
So they're getting there.
Yeah, and also a lot of orders for new aircraft as well, some pretty big commitments moving forward. Do you think that their strategy for such rapid growth is going to work?
Well, so far it is working. Their Q2 results were very good. Their revenue was 8% above last year's. Their H1 is 13% at $1.8 billion. Their quote share and equity share from in the revenue is about $184 million, which is 25% more than last year.
Yeah.
It is 20% of H1 from last year. So they see their strategy seems to be paying off, and their traffic grew by 13%.
Yeah.
Now they have 80 airplanes outstanding, of which 41 airplanes are 787s, and I think they have 10 A380s.
Wow. Okay. So some big orders for some very new aircraft. I mean, given the troubles of the 787, I wonder if that's a bigger risk than maybe we thought a few months ago. But I'm sure they're going to get through it. I mean, they still got a very large fleet, haven't they?
Yeah. I mean, the deliveries are not until next year. So hopefully things will be ironed out by then.
And we're also hearing about an awful lot of growth in Dubai. What's this we're hearing about Dubai Central?
Well, considering that Dubai International Airport is getting very crowded.
Yeah.
And for years, the airport authority has been trying to move people to Dubai World Central.
Osama, just for those who don't know, that is a different airport, is it?
This is it's Al Maktoum International Airport, which is towards it's Jebel Ali, which is closer to the borders with the Emirates of Abu Dhabi. So it's like equidistant between Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
Right. Okay.
Now the airport was supposed to have 5 runways and accommodate 160 million passengers. Right now they have 1 runway, a big cargo center, and low-cost carrier terminal.
Right, okay.
From October this year, there are 2 airlines that are going to start operating in Dubai World Central, which are Nasser from Saudi Arabia. They already operate into Dubai. However, they have agreed to fly an extra 10 flights into the World Central. And there from Hungary, it will be starting its operation into Dubai World Central. Both of them will probably start around the end of October this year.
Right.
Now, General Aviation has basically moved into Dubai World Central. We have ExecuJet and Jet Aviation that have opened up an FBO and a maintenance facility there, joining DC Aviation.
Yeah.
Now, we have to put this in the context of the closure of the runways in Dubai in May 2014.
Right, okay.
Now, Emirates has started building a big cargo facility in DWC, which will be able to take something like 700,000 tons once it starts open and it starts operation.
Yeah.
It will have 12 aircraft stands and about 46 truck docks and 80 truck parkings, and it will start operating in April 2014, and that will effectively move Skyward Cargo, which is Emirates Cargo, into the DWC by middle of next year.
Right. I mean, just talking about cargo, and you mentioned some traffic figures there as well. This region seeing the largest growth in the world by far, I think 10 to 12% growth year on year is coming out in the IATA traffic figures. Does this mean that that Dubai Central will become a real focus for cargo for Emirates moving forward? I mean, they're building, they're investing. Will the world's cargo start to hub through this region a lot more? Certainly, you know, the traditional cargo hubs in Germany and continental Europe, they seem to be stealing business from there. Do you see that this is the next growth area?
Well, DWC already have something like about half a dozen cargo operators operating out of there.
Yeah.
And, of course, Emirates moving over there is going to make it a big hub. I mean, 700,000 tons a year is nothing to laugh at.
No,
now, you have to remember, when they built the airport, they had transmodal transportation in mind. There is a dedicated road that goes from the airport to Jabal Ali, free zone.
Yeah.
And that's a direct, just for the trucks, which is directly from the airport to the port, bypassing all customs and duties and things like this.
Yeah.
So you should actually be able to fly something into World Central, truck it to Jabal Ali Port and put it in a container and ship it out, and vice versa. Within 6 hours, this is what they're actually saying.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for on this week's segment. But I still had a lot that I wanted to talk to Osama about, so we'll bring you the rest of that interview next week. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
And thank you, Peter. Yeah, you know, I think it's pretty clear that if you're interested in commercial aviation at all, you have to be watching what's going on in the Middle East with respect to the airlines there. It's they're major players, major contributors to the sort of the health of the industry, I guess, in terms of orders, which we've seen over the years have been quite large. And hey, you know, it might be interesting to sort of calculate what percentage of the total commercial, I don't know, orders market, or using some measure from the last 5 years or whatever, has originated from that region. I think it would probably be a pretty significant number.
Well, I think an interesting point too is that they're growing by expanding, and we're in the U.S. at least, we're sort of solidifying by merging and somewhat contracting, but certainly not expanding much at all.
Yeah, it's the economics of commercial aviation in the United States certainly is quite different from what you find in the Middle East. Very good. I mentioned at the start that we had a listener story or two, and I think in the interest of time, we're gonna hold those until next week or an upcoming episode. So apologize for that little change. So instead, we'll just move right into the listener mail. And first one came from Ray Rivera, who sent us an article by our friend, past guest Jason Parr from Wired. This is called "Open Source Airplane Could Cost Just $15,000." I think this is fascinating. The article that Jason wrote says that the goal, now this is done by an outfit called MakerPlane, and he says the goal of MakerPlane is to develop a small two-seat airplane that qualifies as a light sport aircraft and is affordable, safe, and easy to fly. But unlike other home-built aircraft where companies or individuals charge for their plans or kits, MakerPlane will give its design away for free. So I haven't seen the open source sort of activity in aviation so much. You find this in other areas where if you're not familiar with it, where the basic idea is that there is no real kind of commercial owner, that instead it's open source, meaning that it's available for everyone at no charge. And so the idea here is to build, or design rather, I guess, an LSA that uses that philosophy and hopefully will result in something that is an option for builders that'll be a lot less than others. You can find more at this MakerPlane website, which is makerplane.org. So if you're interested in learning more about that, you can read Jason's article, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Or in addition, take a look at the makerplane.org website.
Sure, and one thing I would add to that is that the MakerPlane group was inside the Innovation Building at AirVenture, which is a big new building right off of the West Ramp there, Phillips 66 Ramp. And there were all kinds of really interesting companies doing all kinds of really cool things, MakerPlane being one of them. So if you do make it to AirVenture next year, you have got to go to the Innovation Building.
I think I'd spend a whole day in there. That sounds really interesting.
Oh, it was neat.
Yeah, great. All right, well, thanks, Ray, for sending that along. That's very interesting. I also noticed from the MakerPlane site that they've launched a campaign. There's something called Indiegogo. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a way to get funding. There's some other sites like this out there, but this is one where basically you contribute funding. Anyone can contribute funding to help finance this operation. So that's at makerplane.org. Ray Williams sent us an email. He says, pity that Boeing didn't get the Stratocruiser's landing gear designer to do the 737's gear. The Stratocruiser, I guess, David, is the Boeing 377, is that right?
377, yep.
So there's a website that Ray sent along. It's actually, as far as I can tell, it's from an Aeroplane Monthly article from June 1996, I think. The link is kind of long, but look for that in the show notes. Or there's an easy link. You can go to airplanegeeks.com/speedbird, and it'll take you to that article. But if you scroll down, Ray says, if you scroll down about a third of the way, you come across this. It says, it both landed and took off on its nose wheel. And if that was not peculiar enough, the wing leading edges adjacent to the fuselage had an additional strip, which was designed to reduce lift. And then Ray says, you scroll down farther, it says the robustness of the nose wheel leg was proved on almost every landing, as the Strat, when near the ground, had a mind of its own. And we used to arrive, one did not land in a Strat, one arrived, with the most appalling thumps. It says no amount of heaving back on the pole would induce the main wheels to make contact first. And, of course, this is in reference to the recent landing we saw of the Southwest plane coming, the 737 coming down on its nose wheel and then collapsing. And then there's some other interesting quotes from that article, from that webpage that Ray points out. But you know, point being that here's a case where the thing was designed to land nose first, or I guess that's the way it was flown. And Ray also mentions, he says, this was an excellent podcast. Hey, in one show, the Fairy Gannet and the mention of the English Electra Canberra. Who could ask for more? So thanks, Ray.
Won't he be surprised when he hears this episode?
I know. He's just going to be beside himself. We aim to make our listeners happy, don't we, David?
We try.
We heard from Mike. Now, Mike had previously sent in a picture of a Mooney. He said, here's another great registration. This was taken at this year's Boundary Bay Air Show. Now, this is a Sorrel SNS-7 Hyperbipe.
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 Home-built biplane. Home-built cabin biplane.
Oh, really? It's kind of a nice-looking little airplane. Well, this has an interesting registration on it. It spells out a word.
Charlie. Go ahead, Rob. Say it phonetically.
Charlie Fox Uniform Kilo Mike.
There it is. So
Charlie.
Yeah. So Mike says that. Appreciate that. We might or might not put a picture of that in the blog.
Why?
Post.
It's a picture of an airplane.
That's a
Who's
picture of an airplane.
Going to be offended.
Okay. We'll do that. So we thank Mike for sending that along and giving us a good chuckle. And then Dirk wrote in. He said, very much enjoy your weekly podcast that I listen to on my way to and from the airport. He says, the only problem is that there is only one podcast of an hour and a half per week, and my commute is 40 minutes each way several times a week. So, well, we do our part to make this long, but I don't think we're going to make this any longer. So you'll have to stretch it out, Dirk, over your commute. He says, your discussion about cockpit automation in regards to the Asiana crash brings to mind the most frequent last words on cockpit voice recorders. Oh, here we go again. We're still on this theme, aren't we? He says, in the old days, these used to be a word that starts with F, and in another word, it starts with S. He says, but with the increased automation now, it tends to be, why is it doing that, and what is it doing now? Which is kind of interesting. You know, it also reminded me of something I'd seen recently. Another listener sent in, I think we even mentioned it, a quote from this video from 1997 called Children of the Magenta. Got a link to the YouTube video. This was filmed in 97. It's Captain Vandenberg of the American Airlines Flight Academy focusing on the automation dependency and its threat on the flight deck. So it, I think that's what he says, something similar to that in that video. That may be the source of the quote.
Well, it's either that. I mean, we can just go completely automated and not worry about the pilots so they wouldn't have these problems anymore.
That's right. And in fact, Dirk continues, he asks, why is your resident drone? He says, would that be Rob? Why is your resident drone so worried about being clobbered by a drone when emerging from IMC in his SR-22? Surely he must be much more worried about being hit by a drone while still in IMC. And never realizing what actually hit him.
Nope. Well, if you're in IMC and you don't know what hits you, I mean, you wouldn't know what hit you.
Yeah.
If you pop out of the clouds and you see something dead ahead, you have maybe a second or two to get really scared before you die. And that's kind of uncomfortable.
That is a little uncomfortable.
Speaking of drones and dropping things, Grant McCarron commented on our cake delivery service drone article that we said last week, and his comment was that tart is going to become a tort if they're not careful. I thought that was quite brilliant of him. And Rob, we did really wanted to serve you humble pie, but it was cakes they were delivering by drones.
Yeah, we missed you last week, Rob, if for no other reason than just for that story. All right, moving on quickly, we heard from Paul Filmer, one of our favorite aviation photographers. He says he's a little bit behind in listening, but with regards to the TU-154 deploying reverse thrust in the air, you need to bear in mind how the aircraft is built. He says, as you know, all Soviet aircraft of that era were over-engineered and built strong. Back in the day, the HS-121 Trident, also an extremely over-engineered aircraft, used to deploy reverse thrust in the air. In fact, he says, I was in the cockpit with British Airways descending into Frankfurt, and the crew elected to deploy reversed thrust pretty high up to get a better rate of descent. He says, I assume they were vectored late into the descent. Anyway, I was basically hanging in the seatbelt looking at the ground through the cockpit windows. My guess is that this is not done these days, as the aircraft are far more delicate compared to the over-engineered way we built aircraft back in the 50s to the 70s. And Paul says, as David mentioned, the same regarding the C-130. Again, that's another strongly built aircraft. And he says, looking at his passenger logbook, it was December 6, 1980, in Trident 3G AWZG. That was on BA-724.
I got to admit, if I was sitting in the front seat of a jet aircraft like an airliner, and only the ground was visible in my windscreen and my seatbelts were being used, especially the shoulder belts,
nah.
I think pretty much that would scare the hell out of me, too.
Yeah, I think so. Take a look at Paul's webpage, skippyscage.com. I guess put W's in front of that. And he does other kinds of photography, but a lot of aviation photography that's amazing. And, you know, speaking of amazing aviation photography, I discovered, I don't know, through somebody's Twitter comment, Rob, that there was another famous photographer at Oshkosh this year, that being Moose Peterson, who is sort of an icon in the certainly in the nature photography realm. That's where I first ran across his work. But he does some amazing aviation photography as well. And so if you like Paul Filmer's work, some really high-quality aviation photography, also check out Moose Peterson's website, moosepeterson.com, and just look for the aviation tab up at the top. I'll pass that on as a recommendation. Ryan Hothersall also wrote in again and said, concerning aviation careers, not all pilots out there are aiming for an airline job, which I think that's a good point, Ryan. He says, the pilot of my first ever float plane flight in 2006 in New Zealand said he was not remotely interested in an airline job. He was quite happy to fly a Cessna 206 off the lakes of New Zealand. Talking to Canadian float plane pilots in 2011, and I got similar impression that they were happy where they were. You know, I think I'd be perfectly happy with a float plane job, Rob. I just love float planes. They're so cool. All right, so let's just close out mentioning we got a great email from Mick. You know, Australians have, many of them, an interesting and dry sense of humor that's quite entertaining. So Mick sent us a great note. We really appreciate the comments from Mick. So I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Want to thank our guests for our Oshkosh debrief, Mart Klepper and Martin Rotler, both past guests, guys that we should have on more often, certainly. We want to thank Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk Report. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. Find his podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. And you know what else, guys? If you wait for the next episode out later in the week, I'm on the show as Peter's guest. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you. Where can they find you?
Gosh, they can find us at jetwine.com. And I hope everybody does take a minute to go up and read that great story where we talk about some of the cool folks we met at AirVenture this year. And hopefully you guys will be there next year to join us. And Jetwine on Twitter. Jetwine, I think, David, we figured out Jetwine on YouTube.
Jetwine on YouTube, Jetwine on Google Plus.
Right, Jetwine on YouTube, and who knows where else.
Wow.
Well, you don't.
Yeah, he doesn't.
Well, I know, but if I did know, I could probably say it.
You know, we have Airplane Geeks up on YouTube, except we have only one video that's like 2 or 3 years old. We have to fix that.
I don't know.
Take some shots of Simba or something. We should get some video up there. But meantime, David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you online? Well, you got to think about it?
I got to think about it. You can find me on Twitter at... you can find me on the Whitman Twitter feed, the Addison Twitter feed, DM Vanderhoof for Twitter. You can find me on Facebook at David Vanderhoof. You can find me on Google Plus at David Vanderhoof. You can find me celebrating the fact that Peter has been elected the new doctor. And I don't know the rest of it. Have a good week, folks.
All right. Thanks, David. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter. Just look for Max Flight. Also at 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 260. If you want to go straight there, just look for airplanegeeks.com/260. You'll find links to all the sites that we mention on the podcast and some other great stuff. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. You can look for us on YouTube, but you'll only find one old video. We're also on Stitcher.com. You can stream us to your mobile phone. And we're also on TuneIn Radio. Find us there at TuneIn.com. If you want to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. No one will answer the phone, so if you're nervous about that, you don't have to worry. Just call the number and leave a message. And Opene will give us that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night.
Hasta la vista.
We'll be back.
Five, four, three, one.
The reason that was funny, I don't know if you guys heard it, but there was a dropout in the middle of that, and I never heard two. So we'll go.
There was no two.
There was no two.
Five, four, three, two, one.
I may have to do some editing tonight because I can still hear Martin typing.
Sorry. I'm done. Sorry.
Okay.
Martin, if you had done your homework the way you were supposed to, you wouldn't have to be doing it in class.
That's right.
I mean, come on.
Okay, now it's better. You got really, really loud for a second there, Rob.
That's because I was right up on top of the microphone like this. Well, and Max, you know how you get a Husky to run on that kind of gas?
I'm afraid to ask. How, Rob?
Light its tail on fire or something. You feed them hard-boiled eggs and get them to drink a lot of Guinness. Boom, boom. Okay.
I did see...
No wonder everybody wanted me to leave after the bacon party.
Yeah, right.
I was going to say, that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is quite a remarkable young man, I think.
Oh, I thought we were talking about Baz. I was going to say he did quite a good interview. Some of those that come out of Australia.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood, Rob. Okay. He says, I'd like to make 2 points. He says, the discussion about cockpit. Cockpit automation. What is cockpit automation? He says, the pilot of my first ever float plane flight in 2006 in New Zealand.
Yeah, but can you say float plane pilot quickly?
No.
10 times?
No, definitely not. I'll get in a lot of trouble.
Well, then you can't do it. If you can't say float plane pilot quickly, well, anyway.
I know. Both of them from the Crane Plazy Down. Boy.
Folks, you're about to hear the longest Max flight blooper reel in history.
I can't get anything out. I'm on the show as Peter's guest.
Yay!
could you say, Peter? How I'm doing it. Okay, it's just been a long week, folks.
It has been a long week.
And the really sad part about Max being on the podcast is, Rob, pulled a U. I get a text
pulled
message.
A me?
He pulled a U. I get a text message in the middle of the show. Name at least 3 triplanes. I need to know for Peter's podcast. It's like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Technical resources for just about everybody.
I know.
Peter picked a pack of pickled podcasts.
Pickled triplane podcast.
Okay, never mind.
All right, let's folks tell us where they can. I can't get anything out today.
That's all, folks.